Zelar chewed for a moment, thinking. Robbins took advantage of the pause to enjoy his water. It wasn't quite as refreshing as he had previously suggested. "The memories of his little girl don't lead to any tangential memories coming up?" Zillard asked. "Sometimes," Robin said. A picture of Bhutan and his daughter at some research base he was stationed at reminded him of some of the work he'd been doing there, some early research on consciousness buffering before he came back to Phoenix Station and started working on it using the technology we had gotten from the Khonsu. But he didn't remember anything useful in terms of why Bhutan would decide to turn traitor. "Show him another picture of Bhutan's daughter," Zillard said. "We showed him all we could find," Robin said. "There aren't that many, and there aren't any of her physical things around, no toys or drawings or anything like that."
"Why not?" Zillard asked.
Robin shrugged. "She died before Bhutan came back to Phoenix Station," he said. "I guess he didn't want to bring her things with him."
"Now that's interesting," Zillard said.
His eyes looked like they were focusing on something at a distance, a sign he was reading something off his brain pal.
"What?"
Robin said.
"I pulled Bhutan's file while you were talking," Zillard said.
"Bhutan's a colonial, but his work for the Colonial Union required him to be stationed at military research facilities. The last place he worked before coming here was at Covell Research Station. Ever hear of it?"
"It sounds familiar," Robin said, "but I can't place it."
"Says it was a zero-G capable research facility," Zillard said. "They did some biomedical work, which is why Bhutan was there, but it was mostly weapons and navigation systems. This is interesting. The station was actually positioned directly above a planetary ring system. It was just a click above the ring plane. Used the ring debris to test their close-quarter navigation systems."
"Now Robin's got it.
Rocky planets with ring systems were rare, and ones with human colonies rarer still. Most colonists preferred not to live where stadium-sized chunks of falling rock plunging through the atmosphere were a common occurrence, rather than a once-in-a-millennium sort of thing. One with a military research station orbiting overhead, that was pretty singular."
"Oma," Robin said.
"Oma," Zillard agreed. "Which we no longer own. We could never prove that the Oban originally attacked the colony or the station. It's possible the Array attacked the colony, and then the Oban attacked them when they were weakened from fighting us and before they could be reinforced, which is one reason we never went to war with them over it. But we know they decided to claim the system for their own pretty damn quickly, before we could mount a force to take it back."
"And Bhutan's daughter was on the colony," Robin said.
"She was on the station, from what the casualty lists say," Zillard said, sending over the list for Robin's to view. "It was a large station, and would have had family quarters."
"Jesus," Robin said.
"You know," Zillard said, casually, forking the last bite of steak into his mouth,
"when Covell Station was attacked, it wasn't entirely destroyed. In fact, we have reliable data that suggests the station is largely intact."
"Okay," Robin said.
"Including the family quarters."
"Oh, okay," Robin said, the light coming on. "I can already tell you I don't like where this is going.
You said that Dirac's memory responds most strongly to stress and sensory input," Zillard said.
"Taking him to the place where his daughter died and where all her physical things are likely to be would qualify as a significant sensory input."
"There is the minor problem that the system is now owned and patrolled by the Oban," Robin said.
Zillard shrugged. "That's where the stress comes in," he said. He set his utensils into the done position on his plate and pushed it away from him.
"The reason General Mattson took over Private Dirac is because he didn't want him to die in combat," Robin said.
"Dropping him into Oma space seems rather counter to that desire, General."
"Yes, well, the General's desire to keep Dirac out of harm's way has to be tempered by the fact that as of 3 days ago, 4 of my ships and more than 1,000 of my people have up and disappeared as if they never even existed," Zillard said. And at the end of the day, Dirac is still Special Forces. I could force the issue.
Matson wouldn't like it, Robin said.
Neither would I, Szilard said. I have a good relationship with the General, despite his patronizing attitude toward Special Forces and me.
It's not just you, Robin said. He's patronizing to everyone.
Yes, he's an equal opportunity asshole, Szilard said. And he's aware of it, which he thinks means it's okay. Be that as it may, as much as I don't want to get on his bad side, I will if I have to. But I don't think I will have to.
A waiter came over to take Szilard's plate. Szilard ordered dessert. Robbins waited until the server left.
Why don't you think you'll have to? He asked.
What would you say if I told you we already had Special Forces at Omaha making preparations to take back the system? Szilard asked.
I'd be skeptical, Robin said.
That sort of activity would be noticed sooner or later, and the Oban are ruthless. They wouldn't tolerate their presence if they found out about it.
You're right about that, Szilard said.
But you'd be wrong to be skeptical. Special Forces have been at Omaha for over a year now. They've even been inside Covel Station. I think we can get Private Dirac in and out without raising too much attention.
How? Robbins asked.
Very carefully, Szilard said.
And by using a few new toys.
The waiter returned with the General's dessert. 2 large Toll House cookies. Robbins stared at the plate. He loved Toll House cookies.
You realize that if you're wrong and you can't sneak Dirac past the Oban, they'll kill him, your secret Omaha reclamation project will be exposed, and any information Dirac has about Bhutan will die with him, Robin said.
Szilard took a cookie.
Risk, he said. It's always in the equation. If we do this and we botch it, then we are well and truly fucked. But if we don't do it, we risk Dirac never recovering Bhutan's memories, and then we're vulnerable to what the Oban have planned next. And then we'll be well and truly fucked then.
If we're going to be fucked, Colonel, I prefer to get fucked on my feet instead of on my knees.
You have a way with mental imagery, General, Robin said.
Thank you, Colonel, Szilard said.
I try.
He reached over, took the second cookie, and offered it to Robbins.
Here, he said. I saw you coveting it.
Robbins stared at the cookie, then looked around.
I can't take that, he said.
Sure you can,
Szilard said.
I'm not supposed to eat anything here, Robin said.
So what?
Szilard said.
Screw 'em. It's a ridiculous tradition, and you know it. So break it. Take the cookie.
Robbins took the cookie and stared at it glumly.
Oh, good God, Szilard said. Do I have to order you to eat the damn thing?
It might help, Robin said.
Fine, Szilard said. Colonel, I'm giving you a direct order. Eat the fucking cookie.
Robbins ate it. The waiter was scandalized.
Behold, Harry Wilson said to Jarrett as they walked into the cargo hold of the Shikra. Your chariot.
The chariot in question consisted of a carbon fiber basket seat, 2 extremely small ion engines of limited power and maneuverability, 1 on each side of the basket seat, and an office refrigerator-sized object positioned directly behind the seat.
This is an ugly chariot, Jared said.
Wilson chuckled. Jared's sense of humor had improved over the last few weeks, or at the very least, it had become more to Wilson's liking. It reminded him of the sarcastic Charles Bhutan he knew. Wilson felt both pleasure and wariness about this. Pleasure that his and Kynan's work was making a difference. Wariness because Bhutan was, after all, a traitor to humanity. Wilson liked Jared enough not to wish that fate on him.
It's ugly, but it's state-of-the-art, Wilson said.
He walked over and slapped the refrigerator-looking object.
This is the smallest skip drive ever created, he said. Hot off the assembly line. And not only is it small, but it's an example of the first real advance we've had in skip drive technology in decades.
Let me guess, Jared said.
It's based on that Kansu technology we stole from the array.
You make it sound like a bad thing, Wilson said.
Well, you know,
Jared said, tapping his head.
I'm in this predicament because of Khonsu technology. Let's just say I'm not neutral on its uses.
You make an excellent point, Wilson said.
But this is sweet.
A friend of mine worked on this. We'd talk about it. Most skip drives require you to get out into flat time-space before you can engage them. You have to get far away from a planet. This one is less picky. It can use a Lagrange point. So long as you've got a planet with a reasonably large moon, you've got 5 nearby spots in space where it's gravitationally flat enough to engage this drive. If they can work out the kinks, it could revolutionize space travel.
Work out the kinks? Jared said.
I'm about to use this thing. Kinks are bad.
Well, the kink is that the drive is touchy about the mass of the object it's attached to, Wilson said.
Too much mass creates too much of a local warp on the time-space, makes the skip drive do weird things.
Like what? Jared asked.
Like explode, Wilson said.
That's not encouraging, Jared said.
Well, explode is not quite the accurate word, Wilson said.
The physics for what really goes on are much weirder, I assure you.
You can stop now, Jared said.
But you don't have to worry about it, Wilson continued.
It takes about 5 tons of mass before the drive gets wobbly. That's why this sled looks like a dune buggy. It falls well under the mass threshold, even with you in it. You should be fine.
Should be, Jared said.
Oh, stop being a baby, Wilson said.
I'm not even 1 year old, Jared said. I could be a baby if I want.
Help me get into this thing, would you?
Jared negotiated his way into the sled's basket seat. Wilson snapped him in and stowed his MP in a storage box to the side of the seat.
Do a systems check, Wilson said.
Jared activated his brain pal and connected with the sled, checking the integrity of the skip drive and the ion engines. Everything was nominal. The sled had no physical controls. Jared would control it with his brain pal.
Well, the sled's fine, Jared said.
How's the unitard? Wilson asked.
It's fine.
The sled had an open cockpit. Jared's unitard was formatted for hard vacuum, including a cowl that would slide down completely over his face, sealing him in. The nanobotic fabric of the unitard was photosensitive and passed visual and other electromagnetic information directly to Jared's brain pal. As a result, Jared would be able to see better with his eyes covered by the cowl than he could if he were using them. Around Jared's waist was a rebreather system that could, if necessary, provide breathable air for a week.
Then you're good to go, Wilson said. Your coordinates are programmed in for this side, and you should also have them to get back from the other side. Just put them in and sit back and let the sled do the rest. Szilard said that the Special Forces recovery team will be ready for you on the other side. You'll be on the lookout for a Captain Martin. He's got a confirmation key for you to verify his identity. Szilard says to follow his orders to the letter.
Got it?
Got it,
Jared said.
Okay, Wilson said. I'm out of here. We're going to start cycling out the air. Suit up. As soon as the bay doors open, activate the nav program and it will handle it from there.
Got it, Jared repeated.
Good luck, Jared, Wilson said. Hope you find something useful.
He walked out of the bay to the sound of the Shikra's life support system sucking the air out of the bay. Jared activated his cowl. There was a momentary blackness, followed by a rather impressive gain in Jared's peripheral awareness as the unitard's visual signal kicked in. The rushing noise of air thinned into nothingness. Jared was sitting in vacuum. Through the metal of the ship and the carbon fibers of the sled, he could feel the bay doors sliding open. Jared activated the sled's navigation program. The sled lifted from the floor of the bay and slid gently out the door. Jared's vision included the visual track of his flight plan and its destination more than 1,000 clicks away. The L4 position between Phoenix and its moon Bennu, currently unoccupied by any other object. The ion engines kicked in. Jared felt his weight under the engine's acceleration. The skip drive activated as the sled intersected the L4 position. Jared noted the sudden and impressively disconcerting appearance of a broad system of rings less than a click above his point of view, girding the limb of a blue, Earth-like planet to his left. Jared's sled, which had been previously moving forward at an impressive rate of speed, was motionless. The ion engines had stopped firing just before the skip translation, and the inertial energy of the sled did not carry forward after it.